So welcome. Welcome back to those who were here yesterday, and welcome to those just arriving today. How many people are here how many people were not here yesterday? Yeah, several people. So I want to do a little review. A little review from yesterday won't hurt the ones who were here. We've been reading and discussing a fascicle from Dogen Zenji's masterwork, The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, Shobo Genzo. And the fascicle, or it's like a chapter, except fascicles are not, fascicles are standalone pieces that are compiled into a larger work. Although the more Dogen you read, the more you see how all his writing interweaves and the themes and images that he uses. The one that I've chosen for this weekend is called Shinjin Gakudo in Japanese, which translates as Body and Mind, Study of the Way. And Dogen wrote this text in 1242, which was towards the almost to the end of the 10-year period that he spent establishing his first monastery southeast of Kyoto. Just before he moved to the remote location and founded it in the northeast of Kyoto, close to the Japan Sea, where he founded Eiheiji, the training monastery that still exists today. So this time of his first monastery was his most prolific time of writing. Many of the fascicles in the Shobo Genzo were written during that time. And I read that apparently the day before he gave this particular talk, this text that we're reading, he had received a copy from China of the collected teachings of his teacher, his Chinese teacher, Ru Jing. So I think he was kind of inspired when he wrote this, because having received the published record of his own teacher's work. This text, as I said yesterday, is a little unusual in that Dogen speaks of studying the way by taking up the body and the mind, and he speaks of them separately, even though, of course, they're inextricably connected. And even in his writing, we see it's almost circular that body and mind can't be separated. But he gives us more than he usually does, a sense of different aspects of our practice with body and mind. So I thought it would be good to see what he has to say in this regard. We mentioned yesterday that this body-mind connection is made graphically clear in the Chinese and Japanese character for heart and mind, which is represents the four-chambered heart. This is not very beautiful lettering or calligraphy. Sometimes it's very beautiful, but it's this one, which is also pronounced kokoro in Japanese. So it situates our mind in the heart, not within our skull, which is quite different, I think, from the mind-body split that many of us grew up with in our culture. It locates sentience, awareness throughout the body. There are nerve cells throughout our body that through which we relate to our surroundings, to the world. It's how we become conscious of and how we are in relationship to the world. So yesterday we read the first part of the text in which Dogen talks about studying the way with the mind. So I just want to summarize a few points from that. Dogen says, for the time being, let us say, there are two approaches to studying the Buddha way. So for the time being, provisionally. Not because it's true, but for the purposes of this discussion, to study with mind and to study with body. To study with mind means to study with various aspects of mind, such as consciousness, emotion, and intellect. So in the human, those are Dogen's words, in the human mind or psyche, emotion and cognition are inextricably intertwined, you know, feeling and thought. And contemporary neuroscience is confirming this with increasing sophistication. We chant, when we chant the Heart Sutra, that the five skandhas are empty. Body, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, right? We chant that. All five aggregates are empty. All five skandhas are empty, the components of our being. And empty doesn't mean that they don't exist. It means they don't function in isolation. These components that make us up function only in interrelationship with each other and with the world. So that's what emptiness means. And so it's perhaps not the best translation. Kaz Ta-Nehisi, who's done so much translation of Dogen, prefers to use boundless instead of empty, and I kind of like that. So we can't attend to mind without attending to body, to thoughts without attending to emotions. A neuroscientist named Antonio Damasio is the author of a number of books, but one that I read a while ago called Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain. Talks about this relationship between the cognitive mind, the reasoning mind, and the emotional mind. And he was first spurred to explore the relationship between reason and emotion by observing not only historical cases but his own patients who had traumatic brain damage which left virtually all their cognitive abilities intact. There's many tasks that they could do just fine, but destroyed their ability to feel emotion. The result was that they were severely impaired in their abilities to anything to do with relationship, with their family life, their work life, making ethical decisions. Their lives fell apart, and yet they could do cognitive tasks and tests, all the typical indicators show that their basic cognitive intelligence was unimpaired. So Damasio devotes his whole book to an explanation of how this could be true. And the one thing I found particularly interesting and apropos of our practice was that the area of the brain that was damaged in these individuals was the part that perceives our bodily feelings. Is perceiving our bodily feelings is how our brain can know we're afraid, can put a label on those feelings and say we're afraid. Sometimes we mislabel, right? When people have panic disorders, sometimes eliminating caffeine will bring down their symptoms a lot because the feeling of heart palpitations, caffeine stimulation can mimic panic attack symptoms. So sometimes we mislabel those physical feelings, but without them, we don't know how we feel, right? We don't know that we're angry. We don't know that we're frightened or anxious. And that's what happened to these people. And without knowing how they felt, they couldn't also know how another person might feel. They couldn't resonate, and they couldn't function in relational life. Back to Dogen. Don't worry about your text just now, because these are I'm reviewing. Sometimes you study the way by casting off the mind. Sometimes you study the way by taking up the mind. Either way, study the way with thinking and study the way with not thinking. We talked about this yesterday quite a bit. We talked about this core Soto Zen practice of shikantaza, just sitting. Sitting with a very spacious, objectless, no object of concentration, a very spacious awareness of the arising and passing of phenomena. Nothing left out. Everything that arises, comes into attention and passes. But here, Dogen seems to be saying that there's a place in our practice for attending to thoughts. For example, and he doesn't go into detail, but as we all know, when we're meditating, a habit pattern of thought can be really persistent and obstructive and hard to let go of, right? We've all had that experience. So we might bring a patient, non-judgmental, and discerning attention to this mind content, observing it, tracking it, not in an analytical way, but watching it with our Dharma eye, and our penetrating Dharma eye, which will see that this arising is conditioned and it's temporary, right? Impermanent, conditioned, and we don't have to identify with it as ourself. That's how we see with our Dharma eye. So Dogen seems to be implying that there's a place for insight in our practice, paired with and supported by quiet mind. So in traditional Buddhist terms, this would be called shamatha vipassana. Shamatha, quiet, still mind, vipassana, insight. We don't usually use those terms in Soto Zen, but they're there in our practice. So it might be good to kind of just acknowledge that, and so that we can be skillful. As I said yesterday, not think that our goal is to sit with a blank mind. There's precedent for this understanding in earlier Soto Zen writings. The Chinese Zen master Hongzhi, who lived a century before Dogen, and whom Dogen quotes quite frequently, used the phrase silent illumination for Zazen practice. And he emphasized the importance of balancing serenity with illumination. So serenity would be the shamatha, and illumination, the vipassana, the insight, active insight. He said, if illumination neglects serenity, then aggression appears. That's an interesting word. I don't have the original to see. You know, is that a good translation? If illumination neglects serenity, aggression appears. He might mean also, you know, kind of agitation. If serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma.
I think that, please?
If serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. You know, you're sitting there. And it's just murky. Yeah, dull. So, as we become more experienced and skillful in our practice, we can know, we can have a sense when we need to calm and steady the mind, and when we have that stability, when we need to bring awareness active insight to mind content so that we open to the true nature of mind. And this is an experiential, not an analytical insight. Dogen doesn't want us to make study of the way by taking up the mind an intellectual exercise. In the passages we read yesterday, he assures us that our practice must be grounded in ordinary, everyday experience, right? In our experience of the moment-by-moment details of our lives. Remember, everyday mind is the way, as the famous koan says. Ordinary mind, heijoshi. This brings us to the living reality of being embodied human beings, practicing with the body. So today, let's see what Dogen has to say about studying the way with the body. So now you can open up your text to number 19. And again, for people who aren't here yesterday, these numbers are just ones I put in for convenience. You're not going to find them anywhere else. It's just for this weekend. So, if someone could save my voice and read number 19, please. Volunteer, Miriam. Thanks.
To study the way with the body means to study the way with your own body. It is the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. The body comes forth from the study of the way. Everything that comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. The entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. The coming and going of birth and death is the true human body.
Thank you. So you're going to hear him using this phrase, the true human body, a lot. And when he talks about the true human body, he's talking about this boundlessly interconnected organism. Right? We are permeable. The world is always coming into us and passing through us. Right? The body is the medium through which we interact with the world. And it's the locus of our awakening. Right? We perceive our surroundings through our sense organs. We take in nourishment. We excrete waste. Rooted in the muddy water of our messy human lives, the lotus flower opens. Dogen says the entire world of the 10 directions is nothing but the true human body. Walt Whitman, the great American poet, said, "I contain multitudes," right? And then he lists those multitudes. If you've ever read Song of Myself, it goes on and on and on. Leaves of grass. I love that he uses leaves of grass in such a Buddhist way. In Buddhist imagery, grass is the word for the multiple arisings of phenomena in this earthly world coming up from the earth. And so, you know, leaves of grass by Whitman is an expression of that as well. The body is also the driving force of our appetites and desires, right? So we have ambivalent feelings about it. You know, it's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? The body. Or at least we're taught to be embarrassed about our body and its functions. And religions have all too often resorted to teaching us to loathe our bodies in order to get us to behave, right? You know, because it's hard to behave when we're little and when we're big. It's hard to behave responsibly and caringly in our bodies, with our appetites, you know? Even in early Buddhism, the motivation for right conduct often seems to be fear of karmic retribution, right? Or a desire for karmic reward. I mean, you read that in Buddhist, in early Buddhist texts, but fear of karmic retribution and fear of hellfire and damnation hasn't really worked too well for humanity, has it? Really, when you look, greed, hate, and delusion trump those fears. But our practice in Mahayana Buddhism opens up another possibility. Our precepts, our vows to live a life of non-harming, a life that's of benefit, those precepts arise as part of our bodhisattva vows, arise as part of what we talked about yesterday, bodhicitta, that aspiration to awaken, not just for ourselves, but from the realization that we only awaken along with all beings and for all beings. So our precepts arise from that, our intention to behave in beneficial ways arises along with that bodhisattva vow. So Dogen's next passage, in number 20, emphasizes the precepts and the refuges, the three refuges in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, as a framework and a support for our practice. Could somebody read number 20? Yeah, Doug?
To turn this body around, abandoning the 10 unwholesome actions, keeping the 8 precepts, taking refuge in the 3 treasures, leaving home and entering the homeless life is the true study of the way. For this reason, it is called the true human body.
So now he's saying the true human body is the whole of our practice, including how we manifest it in the world, how we live it. Our whole human practice, our true human body is how we live in the world. And he's saying that we need the support of our vows, the precepts, the refuges. This is the structure that has been offered to us and given to us. Those particular, he says, 10 unwholesome actions and 8 precepts, they're just slightly different configurations from the ones that we typically chant and are in our chant books. I'm not going to take the time to go over them right this moment. He's talking about monks who leave the householder's life, right? Leave home, entering the homeless life. Monks are called home leavers, right? But the precepts are of equal value to all of us as lay practitioners. And in our tradition, lay and ordained people take exactly the same set of precepts. And those precepts are much more than simple commandments or rules of conduct. They're really quite inexhaustible practices of awareness, of mindfulness, awareness of body and mind. And they're also deep koans, because we can really look into them as penetrating non-duality, we could say, or seeing the true nature of being through the precepts. What is killing? What is stealing? What is self and other? We can look into deeply in through the precepts. Okay, next section, number 21, someone? Batya?
Those who follow this must not be like outsiders who hold a view of spontaneous enlightenment. Beizong, Zen Master Daizi, said, "If you are attached to the view that original purity and original emancipation are Buddha, or to Zen practice, you are a follower of the outsider's way of spontaneous enlightenment." Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. So here he's quoting Baijiang, who some of you know from some koans that we studied this past fall. One of the classic Chinese Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. And he's saying that although we are all inherently of Buddha nature, we should not be attached to that view and use it as an excuse not to practice. Dogen's point, which he returns to over and over, is that through continuous practice, we realize and actualize awakening. I'll say a little bit more about that outsider's way. It comes up again, and I'm going to wait and tell you what that is referring to later on. But let's keep going. Could someone read 22?
This teaching is not the broken furniture of an abandoned house, or broken tools of an idler, broken tools of leisure or quiet house, but the collected efforts and accumulated virtue of studying the way.
So he's reiterating the same point using figurative language to say that our practice is not passive and complacent. It's not, and I put an alternate translation here. If you look at the original, it says broken tools. And I like that better than furniture. Of not an abandoned house, but the character is, it means both leisure and quiet house. But then by extension, it can mean a lazy, can refer to laziness, you know, someone who just doesn't work hard. Yeah. So the broken tools, or this is a house where someone isn't practicing, right? Broken tools lying around. So he's saying that's not our practice. But the collected efforts and accumulated virtue of studying the way. So our practice is supported by the practice of those who have gone before us. And, you know, part of Zen practice, if you go to a residential center, is taking care of your tools. You know, cleaning your tools, keeping your tools, your knives sharp in the kitchen, and your hose clean, you know, clean the mud off when you're finished working. So it's, I like the analogy a lot. And I always aspire to take better care of my garden tools than I do. okay, just one little short line. I'll just read it. Number 23, the body suddenly leaps up, transparently clear in eight facets. It drops away while entwined around a tree like a wisteria vine. So I think he's saying here that when we are fully attentive and present to our bodily experience, there's a clarity, there's a vivid awareness, a liveliness. And this image of the twining wisteria is kind of intriguing. And this is just my speculation, that it seems to suggest a kind of blossoming, this manifesting forth, still rooted in the earth and connected, you know, to the tree. Okay, could someone read 24? Yeah, please.
Baijiang words are nothing but manifesting this body, awakening beings, and expounding the Dharma. Manifesting another's body, awakening beings, and expounding the Dharma. Beyond manifesting this body, awakening beings, and expounding the Dharma. Beyond manifesting another's body, awakening beings, and expounding the Dharma. Then again, his words are beyond expounding the Dharma.
So this sounds really confusing. But, and I don't think that it's worth taking too much time with it, other than to just say he's actually drawing this from a passage in the Lotus Sutra that describes all the different ways that Avalokiteshvara or Kannon Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of compassion, manifests in the world. Infinite different ways to meet and support suffering beings. So all those different manifestations that he's listed are ways that Bodhisattva manifests in the world. How about, let's go on to 25. Eddie?
Thus, at the moment of dropping away the body, there is a voice that stops all sound. At the moment of renouncing worldly life, the arm is cut off, cut open the bowels, and the marrow is attained. Even if you begin to study the way before the aeon of the King of Emptiness, still your practice as a descendant of yourself is endless.
So these are more dramatic descriptions of the moment that Dogen calls body and mind dropping away. Shinjin Datsuraku. Body and mind. Datsu is the sense of shedding, like a snake shedding its skin, or an insect shedding its a larvae grows and outgrows its skin, the skin splits and falls away. Body and mind dropping away. And awareness vividly present. A voice that stops all sound, the body splitting open to the marrow. He's making a reference there to Bodhidharma, the first Zen ancestor who brought this practice from India to China. When he gave transmission to his disciple Hui Ke, he said, "You have attained my marrow." And Hui Ke, when he first asked to practice with Bodhidharma refused, and again until. The story goes, Hui Ke chopped off his arm, which convinced Bodhidharma. So that's where the translation says the arm is cut off to make that reference clear, but it actually doesn't say the arm is cut off. It says cut open the bowels. And the marrow is attained. But you get the point. The point being, the marrow, the deepest part of our lives now. So when he says renouncing the worldly life here, it doesn't mean we all have to leave our lives in the world and become monks. But in that moment of letting go of our habitual self-focus, when we open to the full vastness of our lives in the world, with no barrier between self and world, we step through the gateless barrier that we talked about yesterday. All those barriers we erect between ourselves and others, ourselves and the world, are ultimately insubstantial. We step through. And then we continue our practice. So I love this image of us continuing to practice as descendants of ourselves. As our children, our own children and grandchildren. We keep practicing endlessly, boundlessly. Which he continues to describe in the next passage. Someone read 26? Yeah. Basha.
The entire world of the 10 directions means that all 10 directions are the entire world. East, west, south, north. The four midpoints, up and down, are the 10 directions. Consider the moment when front and back, vertical and horizontal, are thoroughly reached. To consider means to understand and to resolve that this human body, undivided by self and others, is the entire world of the 10 directions. This is to hear what has never been heard, because directions are all-inclusive and all worlds are alike. The human body means the four great elements and the five skandhas. However, none of these elements or objects are fully understood by ordinary people.
Thank
Only
you.
Sages thoroughly master them.
I hope that makes you feel a little better. So the entire world of the 10 directions is the true human body, undivided by self and other, all inclusive. The human body is the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, the five skandhas, which we mentioned already, form or body, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. These are all ways of looking at the components that make up our being, and which, as I said, function as interrelated parts of our whole system, body, mind, and larger systems that we are part of, living systems. Dogen says, none of these elements or objects are fully understood by ordinary people. Only sages thoroughly master them. So that's a relief. But even if we don't get it, you know, in an intellectual way, we experience it. We experience this all the time. And particularly in moments of really full, vivid presence. And we all have had those. Nothing left out. Izumi Shikibu, a 10th century Japanese woman poet, wrote this short poem. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. I'm going to read that again. This is Izumi Shikibu. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. So in our practice, it's important to notice what we're leaving out. When we're caught up in relentless loops of narrative, worry, argument, doubt, stuck in our heads, it's time to drop our awareness down into the rest of our body, to the sensations in the heart, in the chest, in the belly, to our breath, the actual sensations of our breath. To be present with our embodied experience. And then we can expand it. We can feel the warmth in the palms of our hands, the strength in our legs when we walk. And then we can expand it even more. We can feel the earth beneath us, the gravity holding us here, right? The air around us, warmth, cool. The wonder of flowing water. This is studying the way with the body. And when we're overwhelmed with strong feeling states, fiery anger, cold fear, anxiety, bleak despair, you know, sometimes we are really so swept up in those states. Muddy dullness, there's another one. Then it's time to bring attention to what our habitual thoughts and narratives are going along with those feeling states. And to bring that lens of our Dharma eye to bear on those thoughts, so that we can see that those thoughts, those stories that we tell ourselves, are not the definitive truth. They're always partial, right? Always partial and always provisional. That's our view from here for now. It'll change. And then we can expand that awareness to the larger truth of the human condition, to all the other people who are feeling confused or sad or in physical pain or all the possibilities, right? And we can soften our judging mind, whether we're judging ourselves or we're really mad at someone else. And we can soften our hearts just enough to open to a little more compassion for human beings suffering from greed, hatred, and delusion. And we can open to the vast world of wondrous sentient and insentient beings all around us, just waiting to help us wake up, waiting for us to pay attention. And then we can open to the next moment of simple presence, nothing left out. Nothing left out. And in those moments when body and mind drop away, and we're still and empty, we're ready to meet those 10,000 things that come forward, to meet us. And with the great poet William Blake, we can see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So, back to Dogen's words, number 27, someone? Todd, thank you.
Now penetrate the 10 directions within one particle of dust, but not confine them to one particle of dust. Construct a monk's hall and a Buddha hall within a single particle of dust, and construct the entire world in the monk's hall and the Buddha hall. In this way, the human body is constructed, and such construction comes from the human body. This is the meaning of the entire world of the 10 directions is the true human body.
Thank you. So, a monk's hall and a Buddha hall and a grain of sand. That reminds me of the wonderful story when the Buddha says, he's out walking with the Sangha, and he says, this is a good place to build a temple, right? And who is it?
It's Manjushri.
Is it Manjushri? Who says?
It's a Mahakashapa.
No, it's Mahakashapa, I think. And he says, this is a good... He takes a blade of grass and sticks it in the mouth. I've built the temple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a monastery... In a moment, which is sort of what we do, you know, at home. You sit, and you're in the zendo. And you're in the true human body. The entire world of the 10 directions, the true human body. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to thank you for listening. And I'm going to invite you... to, as we did yesterday, get in small groups of three. And here are the questions that I'd like to invite you to consider. And you can take a moment to just jot down some thoughts first if you want. First question is, what do you tend to leave out in your practice? In your awareness. It could be in your everyday awareness or also in your actual meditation practice. What do you tend to leave out? Body? Mind? Other people? The world? What do you tend not to notice? What do you tend not to attend to? And then how might you make your practice more all-inclusive?
How?
Yeah. And again, I'm talking about in your everyday life as well as when you're sitting in zazen, both. How might you make your practice more all-inclusive? Okay. So just take a minute just to make a few notes for yourselves, and then we'll arrange you in groups. Okay.